From Buck's studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us now at 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, cookie dough, to eat or not to eat? That is the question. We'll talk about research and what it means to you. And we're going to talk about blood pressure guidelines, the new ones. What do they mean for you? Are they real? And more importantly, are they important?
And a yummy recipe?
Japanese cucumber salad. It's one of those simple recipes, 5 ingredients. So actually, if you're listening, you could actually write down on your smartphone the 5 ingredients and put this together. It's a simple recipe for simple times.
What's a smartphone?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's get to the phones now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Our first caller joins us from Slinger, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I love your show.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
I have a question of your thoughts on colonoscopies. I understand that for some people who are at a high risk or a medium risk, that they may be necessary. For myself, I've had 3 in my life, one at 40, one at 50, one at 55, and, of course, now I'm 65, so no issues, no family history of cancer. I eat organic, homeopathic, plenty of multiple vitamins, don't smoke, don't drink, but I can spend money like a drunken sailor. But nonetheless.
I don't think spending money is a risk factor for colon cancer. It's a risk factor for bankruptcy, but not for colon cancer.
When I was a drunken sailor.
Those are the D's. They cannot be repeated over the air, as this is public radio and is not one of those talk shows.
So nonetheless, talking about the colonoscopy, I have a great doctor who is a functional homeopathic doctor, and he just said, you know, it's up to you. He said, you're very low risk, and there have been no issues in the past. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's talk about screening tests for cancer. The only screening tests for cancer that have been proven to be worthwhile scientifically are mammograms for women and colonoscopies for women and for men. That's it. We don't have a screening test for stomach cancer. We don't have a screening test for lymphoma, for leukemia, for pancreatic cancer. Prostate cancer, yes, we pick it up, but there's no difference in the death rate because men die from something else. So these are the two things. Now, the fact that you've been good in the past means that you're low risk, but I want to talk a little bit about it. Why did they do 5 years between one of those colonoscopies and the other? Because usually it's every 10 years. And why did they start at 40? Because the guidelines say you start at 50. Do you have a family? Do you have a family history?
No, there was a suspect thought that my grandmother, who had passed away that year, may have passed away from colon cancer, and I mentioned it to the doctor. Oh, well, we got to have a colonoscopy.
But your grandmother did not pass away.
No, there's no family history whatsoever of any cancer, and from any of my siblings that have had them, nothing.
Okay. So colon cancer screening. To argue that even though you're eating right, taking homeopathic medicine, life is good and you're exercising, to argue that you are at no risk is incorrect. You're not at no risk. You're at a low risk. So you don't have to do a colonoscopy. Low-risk patients can do, it's called a fecal occult blood test, and it's actually a test that you can do once a year. It's a poop test. You poop and you go bring it back to your doctor's office. You don't bring the poop back in a bag to your doctor's office, but you get a little card. You're at low risk. We have a lot of patients that you do it. You do it once a year. If it's positive, because it checks for blood in your stool, then a colonoscopy is warranted. If it's negative, you simply do that every year, and it's very simple. And we have a lot of people who do that who don't want to do colonoscopy. So that's what I would recommend.
I love that. And what is it called? What kind of
It's a fecal occult blood test. That's what it is. And there was an older test where you couldn't eat meat for 3 or 4 days. The newer test is more specific to human blood. So it's a very specific test given out the doctor's office. You do it once a year. Now, I would be remiss if I did not mention Cologuard. Now, Cologuard is the new kid on the block. It's more specific. We don't yet have the information on how often that has to be repeated. And I had a patient in my office, and that patient asked me, how often should I do Cologuard? And right now the recommendations for that is it's every 3 years. But the fecal occult blood test, although it's every year, is very cheap. It's very inexpensive. So I'm recommending to patients, if you're low risk, which you are, a fecal occult blood test every year. Forget the colonoscopy. If it's negative, you're good to go. And those are the recommendations by the U.S. Preventive Task Force also. So, yeah,
awesome.
You don't need a, but I caution you, don't expect it to be zero because you're still at some risk because we are. And colon cancer is so curable if it's picked up early. So pass this on also to your homeopath or functional medicine doc.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Yep. Keep up the good work.
Appreciate the call. Thanks so much. Now, a colonoscopy is not necessary after a certain age.
Well, they're right.
I'm That's after that certain age, and I want to know, is that because I'm going to die before I get colon cancer, or is it because I'm less likely to have
colon cancer? No, you're actually not less likely. The theory behind that, which I disagree with, the theory behind it is you're more likely to die before the colon cancer gets you. No, that's exactly what it is. And I don't think there's any evidence that you're at lower risk, although if you've been at, you're at a low risk because for all those years you haven't had colon cancer, doing the poop test once a year is still, I think, worthwhile. And there are a number of physicians who agree with that and recommend that you continue with the poop test or colonoscopy as long as you are functional and active. The issue is we don't have any evidence to support the claim that doing a colonoscopy for men and women over the age of 75 is worthwhile. Now, even though we don't have the data, that doesn't mean we don't have to act. I mean, we may not get the data for 5 years or 10 years or 15 mm-hmm. or 20 years because the reality is we don't have more people who are healthier over the age of 80 than we ever had before. You look at octogenarians, and they've multiplied by 5 in the last 30 years, and they're more functional. And even though it's very interesting because they just looked at the data, even though they're more likely to be disabled, the disability is they need a cane. In other words, they're not more likely to be seriously disabled. It may be they have to have somebody bring the laundry basket upstairs from the basement mm-hmm. because they're at risk for falling. Very interesting data. So my recommendation is no. You should do the poop test every year or get a colonoscopy.
So I should, see my family doctor.
Definitely, there's no doubt. Your family doctor says no, switch doctors.
I have a feeling he'll say yes. 800-462-7413.
There's a little humor in that discussion, isn't there?
800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, before our next call, some cookie dough.
Right. To eat or not to eat? That is the question. Now, Tom, you've tasted cookie dough. Did your mother ever make cookies?
I don't think so,
How about your grandmother?
I didn't ever know my grandmother.
How about your aunts and uncles or anything else? Did you ever taste cookie dough?
I have tasted cookie dough on occasion. It's not something I'm crazy about.
Yeah, but you know, when I make cookies around the house, I always taste the cookie dough. And my kids always taste the cookie dough. And my wife Penny always tastes the cookie dough.
But no, it says here, reasons not to eat cookie dough.
Right, right. So we have to, first of all, we have to look at it. First of all, let's take this seriously. This is an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. And sometimes, you know, New England Journal of Medicine has some good stuff. And they looked at flour. And they discovered that, lo and behold, flour can actually have E. coli. Now, we think of E. coli as living in meat products, that can have E. coli. And because generally wet stuff, leafy vegetables can have E. coli, spinach can have E. coli because, E. coli generally come from animals. But this is flour that may have been sitting on the shelves for years. And lo and behold, there was an outbreak in New England where they had 56 patients in a state over a 24-hour period that were hospitalized, and many of them ate
cookie dough.
Cookie dough.
Huh. So we shouldn't eat cookie dough.
Well, you know, these are the. Let's go back to a second. But before we say we shouldn't eat cookie dough, we have to look at the reality, and then we have to look at what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And I want to make an aside for this. In our, I'm part of a large medical group, and in our washrooms, they just pasted the WHO guidelines for washing your hands. And the WHO guidelines are wash your hands for 20 seconds. And I looked at this thing and I said, this is so dumb. Who's going to stand in the washroom for 20 seconds washing their hands?
Looking at your watch.
Have you tried washing your hands for 20 seconds? I thought you do. You have to wash your hands, but you usually wash it for like 5 seconds or 10 seconds. I mean, before I go into a procedure, yes, I'm going to wash it for 20 seconds. But if I do it for 20 seconds all the time, I'm never going to have time to see patients. I'm going to be behind more than before. So I looked at these guidelines and I thought, reality? Ideal situation. Reality, ideal situation. So ideally, you should not eat cookie dough. Okay. Now, if you've got HIV/AIDS, if you're on chemotherapy, if you have serious medical diseases where you're on serious amounts of prednisone, if you're on drugs like Humira that reduce your immunity because Humira is a drug that we use in rheumatoid arthritis, I think you ought to stay away from cookie dough. I think that's the case. But when I make chocolate chip cookies and my granddaughter, Bella, is in the room, do you think I'm not going to give her cookie dough? Come on. The chocolate chip cookie's there and I'm going to give her cookie dough. And the reality is she going to get it? Probably not, because she's a healthy child. But the reality, it's in there. Sometimes I think we also go very far, and I think, you know, the New England Journal of Medicine, sometimes the people on the East Coast are a bunch of East Coast puritanical snobs who don't eat cookie dough and believe that two drinks is too many, you know, when it comes to alcohol. The reality is two drinks are really okay for most of us, and so is cookie dough. So the question, to eat or not to eat, that is the question. It depends. If you are healthy, don't eat a lot of cookie dough because you're a little bit of risk. And if you're using ground beef and you want to taste it like I often do, be a little bit careful. But the reality is, and when it comes to sushi, maybe you shouldn't eat sushi because there's a risk of hepatitis with sushi. And remember, when you drive to that restaurant, be careful because your risk of death in the car is probably there too. Yeah. Maybe we should just stay at home and eat TV dinners because they're cooked well enough. That's my feeling.
This is a really informative program. What I've learned, I should get yearly tests for colon cancer, and it's probably okay to eat cookie dough.
Even though there's a small risk. That's right.
You Let's see if we can help another listener. A listener joins in now in Newburgh, Oregon. Hi, how can we help?
Well, I have an issue with, I lost a sense of smell about 8 years ago. And it created a nerve pain in my face, and they put a tag on that called trigeminal neuralgia.
Okay. So let's talk about that for a second. You lost the sense of smell. Was there any injury involved, by the way? Did you hit your head or bang your head or anything?
No. I've never really figured out why the jaw started hurting.
Okay. So the trigeminal neuralgia, terrible stuff. Tell me exactly what happened. Where were you? People can usually, it's a lightning-like sharp pain. Came out of nowhere?
That's basically what it did. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was my teeth. Mm-hmm. So I went to the dentist and he pulled four or five teeth.
Wait a second. You went to the dentist and your dentist pulled four or five teeth?
Yes. Uh-huh. And I told him, I said, that's enough pulling the teeth. That's not the problem.
Yeah, it's not the problem.
No, it was on the right side of my face, on my upper jaw. Mm-hmm. And it still bothers me a little bit, but not as much as it used to.
How did they make the diagnosis? You went to your family doc or internist or neurologist? Who finally made that diagnosis for you?
Actually, when I decided to do something about it, I was actually on vacation in Arizona, and a couple of dentists there got together, and they come up with this trigeminal neuralgia thing, you know.
Did they give you any medication, a drug called gabapentin?
Yes, they did. Gabapentin, and it about put me in a hospital.
Oh, the gabapentin. So you had side effects from that. Oh,
yes.
You had a side effect from that. Any of the other anti-seizure drugs that they put you on for this pain, or just that was the only, that was the only one they did?
More.
Yeah, you wouldn't take, because there are other drugs in that class that also can work for that. So the trigeminal neuralgia has settled down a little bit from the pain point of view.
Uh, Yes, it has. Mm-hmm. If that's really what it is, it just, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can, the trigeminal nerve has three branches, and basically it feeds a lot of the face, feeds the upper part, middle part, lower part. Pain and discomfort can feel, the pain in your teeth are from the trigeminal nerve that's actually coming, you know, that is actually coming out there. And it sounds like something happened within your neurological system that actually produced all of this problem, and that part of the nerve died. That's ultimately what must have occurred. So you still taste salty, sweet, sour, bitter, right, on your tongue?
Yes.
So you still taste that? Uh-huh. Must be very difficult for you. What does food taste like to you?
Sometimes it's kind of bland, but mm-hmm. sometimes some things I can taste a little bit, you know, just from remembrance, I guess. I don't.
Well, maybe it could be the remembrance that's in there, or you might still have some, you know, some fibers we taste mostly with our sense of smell.
Yes.
Unfortunately, there's once that part of the nerve dies, there is nothing we can do about it. There's nothing at all. I mean, it's, but the issues are you then have to be very careful. So, for instance, when you take an alcoholic beverage, what does it taste like?
I don't drink.
Right. Well, if you drank, you wouldn't be able to tell. So if you drank vodka, you wouldn't be able to you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between vodka and water. And so people have to be very careful when they're in situations because they don't necessarily know, especially if they're younger people and they've had an injury, which produces a loss of sense of smell. And then, of course, you don't have the sense of smell, so you have to depend visually on whether or not the food is safe and whether or not it's old because you can't smell. And so,
exactly.
You know, that is not it. I wish I could help you. I wish I could give you something magic, but there's nothing magic in there. At least you're not getting your teeth pulled. So that dentist thought it was it was from your teeth.
Yes, that's kind of what he thought. And after about the fourth one he pulled, I said it just would jump from the one you just pulled to the next one. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Yeah, because it was the nerve that was actually feeding that. So. Well, good luck to you. Make sure you're really safe with the things that you have. And if you're at a party and there's a punch, you got to ask what's in the punch. Because, you know, like I said, the alcohol, you don't drink. And if you don't drink, you want to make sure that you don't have, you can't do it with the sense of taste because that part is gone. So good luck. Don't get your.
My wife is just the opposite. She smells everything.
So she does the tasting. You're like the king in the house. She does the tasting before you actually do it.
I don't know if I'm the king or not, but she does the tasting.
No, I think you're the king. You ought to call her.
Yeah.
You should say I'm the king. See how
there
that,
you go.
See what
I'm
that gets
her that.
You.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
See how far that goes.
Before we take a quick break now, Zorba, let's fire up another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
The following email came to us from a listener named Luther in Minnesota. He writes, please issue a stronger caution on using Dremel products on human tissue. The high RPMs generated using a Dremel, particularly on an elderly patient with lessened sensitivity, can cause burns. I had the bright idea to use my father's Dremel on his heavily fungus-infected toenails.
Bright idea. We know where this is going, by the way. Yeah. You know, even if you don't read the rest of it, you know where Tom is going with this.
Okay, here it comes.
here it comes.
Bright in less idea. Than a minute, I noticed a burning smell and a melting of the toenail. The burn on Dad's toe was small, but could have been much worse. Worse because he never felt the heat of the friction from the worn sanding drum I was using. The Dremel is a great tool, but is not meant for use on living tissue by the average Joe. Pedicure grinders.
How about the average Jane, if we're talking about the average Joe?
Pedicure grinders spin at safer speeds, meant to avoid the buildup of friction heat. Thanks. I love the show.
Well, he's right. You know, the off-label use of the Dremel is surprisingly common. And as I said, I've had people who have Dremeled their toes. I have never recommended it. Oh, never would do something like that. I would never recommend off-label use of a Dremel. Nonetheless, one has to be super careful if one uses it. But he's right. If you can get like a lower RPM, the people that I've seen who have Dremeled the toe, actually, they zzz, then they stop. It sounds like this guy was, oh, my God, I can feel something smelling. So I think he was probably, maybe he was the, I don't want to say the below average Joe, but he was not the expert, the expert Joe with the Dremel. So advice taken. Thank you so much for the comment.
Mm-hmm. Did something Zorba said on the show really grind your gears? Keep Zorba on his toes by posting on our Facebook page or sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or through Facebook.
More calls coming up, as well as our tasty recipe, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number is 800-462-7413, 800-462-7413. But now, Zorba, before we get to the recipe, let's take a minute to set it up. The following email came to us from a listener, Chris, in Watertown, Wisconsin. He writes, Tom, did you get after Zorba about his too fancy, expensive recipes? We lowly, low-income listeners can't afford avocados, expensive zillions of spices, and in rural areas, duh, where the heck are the specialty food stores? Growing up, my mother, with 2 acres of garden on our farm, had to make simple foods. She was a magician, and she made an incredible sliced cucumbers recipe. Our family thought that we were in heaven when she made those. Zorba, we love you, but please find simple but great recipes for people working 2 or 3 low-wage jobs who make every effort to listen to your show.
All right.
Tom, keep him in check. Thank you.
You know, it's very interesting. First of all, you're right about avocados being expensive, because they are. Mm-hmm. Avocados are expensive. And when I was a student, I had to choose between liquid milk and tomatoes. And mm-hmm. I talk about that all the time, that if I had tomatoes, then I had Sanilac, which was the best dried milk, powdered milk that was around, but it doesn't really taste like fluid milk, and what I call fluid milk. So I do want to talk for just a second about,
sure,
from a spice point of view, you can go to, there are, you know, grocery stores, the difference in around where we live in Madison, Wisconsin, between the most expensive grocery store and the most inexpensive grocery store, it can be as much as 20%. So I'm not going to mention names, but I shop at both grocery stores for different things. Mm-hmm. In one store, I'm always amazed at how much I get. In the other store, I'm always amazed at how much I don't get. And there really is a difference. So looking at selective shopping makes a difference. But purchasing spices is an inexpensive way to take a variety of foods that and make them taste better. So one of the things I recommend, especially if you're on a limited income, is you go to an inexpensive grocery store when you find it, and you get a variety of spices that are on sale in the right way, and then you use them, and then you can turn anything into a beautiful thing. So I'm going to talk about this, for instance. So this is the Japanese cucumber salad. We are going to start with 2 medium cucumbers. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, Tom, but there are a variety of cucumbers now in the grocery store. There are regular cucumbers, which is what I buy. And then there are fancy cucumbers. They're burpless cucumbers, they're called. I have no idea. Cucumbers never made me burp. Did you ever burp with a cucumber?
I don't think so, no.
But these are longer cucumbers with fewer seeds. Mm-hmm. And they're much more expensive. I think they're like two or three times
You'll
as much.
You'll be surprised. I haven't noticed that at all.
I'm shocked. I don't know. Have you ever noticed the cucumbers? I'm trying to ask. Have you guys noticed the cucumbers?
Which ones?
Which ones? You mean there's more than one cucumber? The long tapered cucumbers, sometimes they're called English cucumbers.
Nah, you should just get the regular ones.
My goodness, these are non-shopper gourmet people. They're just looking at regular cucumbers. So anyway, we start out with two medium cucumbers. You can spend three times as much if you notice them in the store.
I was wondering if we were ever going to get to the recipe.
I just want to say there are different things. So some people who have more discretionary income may take these other cucumbers because they have a different texture. Yeah, there really is a difference in them.
Two medium cucumbers. That's the regular old-fashioned cucumbers, not the newer fancy.
Right, which I don't know. Yeah. A quarter cup of rice vinegar.
Quarter cup rice vinegar?
Now, in a small rural area, you may not be able to find rice vinegar. And if that is the case, I would recommend apple cider vinegar. But there is a difference in the taste between rice vinegar and others. Now, I'm going to go on this a little bit about money. I've looked at consumer reports and studies on things like vinegar and wine to see can people really make a difference between expensive rice vinegar and the cheapest rice vinegar. And you know what the answer is?
No.
It's the label.
In other words, the
expensive one has a better label, but there's no difference in the taste.
Okay.
Get cheap rice vinegar. One tablespoonful of sugar.
Big tea sugar.
Quarter teaspoon of salt.
Quarter little tea salt.
Two tablespoonfuls of sesame seeds toasted.
Two big tea sesame seeds toasted.
That's right, and you can usually get sesame seeds. Okay, number one, peel the cucumbers, leaving alternating green strips. So you're kind of peeling it, you know, so it looks striped. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a striped cucumber?
Sure.
Good. That's what you do. Now, slice the cucumbers in half lengthwise. Scrape the seeds out with a spoon. And that's exactly with a regular cucumber, really easy. And that does make a big difference. Mm-hmm. Simple to do. Now, using a food processor or a sharp knife, cut them into very thin slices and place a double-layer paper towel and squeeze to remove the excess moistures. Cucumber has lots and lots of moisture. So you've got these little strips. Mm-hmm. A sharp knife, very thin little slices, push it with a paper towel, and you get rid of the moisture. Now, combine the vinegar, sugar, salt, and a medium bone, stirring to dissolve it. And let me tell you, you've got to mix it a lot. Use a whisk. If you have a whisk, it's surprisingly hard to dissolve. I've done this before when I've made pad thai. It's hard to dissolve that, dissolve it, but you have to. Add the cucumbers and sesame seeds. Toss it well. You're done. Mm-hmm. You're done. And if you can't find toasted sesame seeds or you don't feel like toasting your own sesame seeds, which is really easy to do, you just put them in a pan and kind of toast them in a nonstick pan. You can use regular sesame seeds. Easy, cheap, inexpensive.
Easy recipe. Sounds pretty good. Want to talk with Zorba? 800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. And now Zorba, a listener, joins in from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I'm a former vegetarian, and I very recently...
Former. A recovering vegetarian, is that what we say?
My kind of
gal. Yeah, I guess.
Recovering vegetarian, that's right.
Recovering vegetarian. That's actually very accurate.
That's a much better way. If you're going to put it and you're going to tell people, say, I'm recovering vegetarian, and their eyebrows will go up.
She saw the light.
That's right. It's different than a former vegetarian. It's a totally different feel, doesn't it?
Well, I'm regrettably not one. I was one for ethical reasons, and then I decided to try the Whole 30, which is the paleo kind of with no sugar at all.
Okay.
And I started out with bone broth to kind of get my gut adjusted, and then I went with chicken, and chicken was like godsend. I was so happy, and I felt amazing, and I'm just curious about like the changes that I will see because I'm reaching the end of my Whole 30. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep on going with paleo, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to kind of like get your take on the changes I would see and what kind of goes on in the body And, like, for example, I've had two amazing things happen. Mm-hmm. One is my inflammation is basically nil. Like, my feet don't hurt. My legs don't hurt. Mm-hmm. I feel amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I took my blood pressure at the store.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it was the lowest I have ever seen.
Sure.
I was actually kind of a little worried that it might be too low.
No, it doesn't get too low. Blood pressure really doesn't get too low in 99% of the people. It may get too low for people on medications, but natural blood pressure being too low, so we actually have to give something to elevate blood pressure. In my office, it happens once a decade. I mean, those are people who have adrenal problems, not people who are normally healthy. So your blood pressure dropped, and if you measured your blood sugar, I bet your blood sugar would have dropped too. And it's just, and that it's very interesting. People who are not diabetic can tolerate very low blood sugars, and they're really good. And diabetics can't necessarily tolerate this. Sounds like it's working for you. Boy, you had a major—you made a major change in what you're eating. What motivated you to do this?
Well, my husband has celiac disease, and so does my daughter. And it was a grain-free, so I felt like that was going to be something that was going to be an easy transition.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like I just was doing some research, and I kept on seeing paleo, paleo, paleo.
Mm-hmm.
And that people on paleo were less sick. We've been sick a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I just felt like maybe we were chronically inflamed and we were just always getting sick. We were just really susceptible. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of done. I was like, you know what? I'm done thinking I'm treating myself by buying a sugary sweet. I'm done. You know, I was just ready for a life change, and we all were, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, that's part of it. There's no one way of eating that's perfect for everyone. We are a diverse, you know, humans are diverse. Their needs are diverse. You know, you have two people, you know, in, as you say, in your house, who have celiac disease, which is serious, you know, gluten intolerance. So all of a sudden, you're limited in that way on what's available. And then if you start limiting yourself too much, for instance, the Zen macrobiotic diets, people who are following that years ago, got scurvy. I mean, scurvy is gone from society. I mean, it used to be a big issue back in the 1700s. And in California, there were periodically outbreaks of scurvy because people were limiting themselves so much. So you've got to find a way of eating that works for you, that you enjoy and gives you pleasure. And I think I think that's really part of it. Part of eating is that it's fun. And, you know, if you're a Puritan and you want to, you know, put yourself, you know, put yourself in a situation where you're not having fun, it's like, well, why am I doing that? I'm in a blockade or whatever those things are. The Puritans, what were they called? The Puritans put they were, you know, they put their arms
I know what you're talking
about. Yeah, but we all know, what it looks like. Right. I mean, sometimes, you know, we're just ridiculous. So, you have a question. What's your question?
Oh, well, it was basically about, like, what kind of things to expect to see happen. I've already dropped 10 pounds, which I have previously not been able to lose any weight at all. Oh, and I wanted to ask about insulin-resistant carbohydrates.
Well, first of all, you have dropped 10 pounds. So, therefore, your insulin resistance, if you have it, is going to be better. We know that when you drop weight, you have less insulin resistance. Now, is it exact? Not exact, but we know that people who are overweight have resistance to insulin, and the body has to produce more and more. People who are normal weight and exercise, the exercise being a very key issue, it's not just weight, it's also moving your body, have less insulin resistance. We know that people who eat lots and lots of refined sugars, so all of a sudden they have spikes in their insulin, will tend to produce more insulin resistance over time. And people who eat a diet where everything is kind of smooth throughout the day, doesn't have to be carb-free at all, but it's smooth throughout the day, have less insulin resistance. So you've lost 10 pounds, you're feeling better, you're doing well, the paleo is working. If your family likes it, that's you know, that's the way you eat. So I mean, I think you're I think you're doing a great job. And also because they've got to because of the celiac disease, they really you want to make sure they get a variety of other things. So there's no one way. I think being a recovering vegetarian gives you credibility in what you're doing. If you go on the talk circuit making money, you start out by saying I'm a recovering vegetarian. You can even start a group like Alcoholics Anonymous, Vegetarians Anonymous. Recovering Vegetarians Anonymous. That's exactly it. So, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
So I was a vegetarian for a day. Can I call myself recovering vegetarian?
No. 800-462-7413. Before the break now, Zorba, let's crack open the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and tackle a quick listener email. This one came to us from a listener named Sarah. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba. My husband and I discovered the joys of downhill skiing several years ago, and we love it. The trouble is, every time we go for a week's holiday, I'm hit with altitude sickness, but my husband isn't. Is there anything you can recommend to help me prevent or overcome this mile-high malady, this mountain malaise, this alpine ailment? P.S. My husband Frank also wants me to ask you how to grow a gloriously bushy mustache like your own."
Well, the first thing you could do is change husbands. You know, get a husband that gets altitude sickness. So he's normal.
You're not available.
Growing and saying, "I don't have altitude sickness. Ha, 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 ha." Yeah. Change husbands. But yeah, the drug is Diamox. D-I-A-M-O-X. Comes in a generic. You get the short acting. I recommend the short acting versus the long acting. Pretty effective, not 100%. Mm-hmm. You start it the day before. It is actually a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor diuretic. Fancy word, and used to be used for a number of things like glaucoma, but it works for high altitude sickness. It'll take a little bit of the edge off. What I do when I go skiing is the first day I'm in the mountains, especially if I'm driving out there, I stay in Idaho Springs. Idaho Springs is at about 6,000 feet, maybe 7,000 feet. So the first day I'm like that. But if I go automatically to 10,000 feet, I also get sick. And the other thing is that first day on the ski hill, sometimes it's day number one, day number two, I kind of take it easy and take a break, make sure I'm hydrated, all those things. But I have to cut out early because the reality is I don't feel good. It takes a while for your body to adjust. And those are kind of the things that I would recommend. Now, on to growing the mustache. Change your parents because it's a genetic thing. And just change your parents and you can grow the mustache.
Have a question for the good doc? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
Interesting research coming up. More of your calls, of course, at 800-462-7413. All coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is our number. But Zorba, before our next call, new guidelines on blood pressure.
Right. Now, these are important guidelines. There really are changes. And I want to bring this out because people go, "Why? They just don't know what they're doing. They change the guidelines all the time. And, you know, what do doctors know?" The reality is this is the first major change in guidelines since 2003. That's a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a long time. And the guidelines are based on some major studies. It was a review of 1,000 studies that the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology reviewed 1,000 research papers and looked at roughly a whole bunch of things. And investigators assigned, this was the big study that they looked at called SPRINT, nearly 10,000 people, 50 years of age and older, okay? They had people who are looking at, they have to get their blood pressure below 140 over 90, and people, they had to get their blood pressure 130 over 80, which are the new guidelines. Now, these are people who had a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, and that's a major point. The risk factor might be age, 65 or older. The risk factor might be blood, you know, the fact that your blood sugar is a little elevated. It might be that you have obesity and a sedentary lifestyle. And they found that participants who got their blood pressure below 120 had a reduction in heart attacks and stroke by roughly a third. by a third, and the death rate fell by roughly a quarter. So these were magnificent numbers, very major changes in numbers that are rethinking what we're doing. Now, the issue is a number of people who have not been treated for high blood pressure will now need treatment because they've got a risk factor. But it also means a number of people who are treating for high blood pressure, we are not giving enough medication to. Now, why is that? Well, people say, I'm going to take another pill. You already have me on two pills. Why should I be in three pills? Wrong. You need three pills, reduces stroke. Or they'll go, wait a minute, you're increasing the blood pressure pill. I don't want to take more of this. I'm concerned about it. Wrong. Mm-hmm. We've got to figure out how to give you a pill that doesn't give you side effects. It also means you may have to make a change in your lifestyle. You may have to get up slowly when you actually stand up from a chair that you've been sitting in too long anyway, because you make it dizzy. What they discovered was we have been too lax because we've been worried about side effects, and especially in people who are older. Mm-hmm. Wrong. We have to be more intensive. Blood pressure treatment has dropped stroke by 75% since I started medical school.
I've always had low blood pressure, but haven't had it taken recently. How often should I be tested?
Well, I should get blood pressure checked once a year. That's all. If you're fine, once or twice a year. If you're on pills, you should get blood pressure checked more often. But if you're on pills or you wonder if you have high blood pressure, check with your doctor. The new guidelines are really important. They should be applied right now. The study is good. It's a major change. Go for it.
1-800-462-7413, our number. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
So, for the last 4 years, I've been suffering from what was recently diagnosed as dyshidroic eczema, which I didn't know what it was, so I was treating it incorrectly for the last 4 years. And I just went to a dermatologist, and they prescribed me some steroid creams for when it flares up.
Mm-hmm.
But
there's
I haven't really gotten any information on how to avoid flare-ups in general, if there's different lifestyle changes I could make or diet changes that would help me avoid these flare-ups from happening.
Oh, sure, sure. So how long has it been going on for?
About 5 years now.
Quite a long time. Quite a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the dermatologist didn't tell you about soaps and dryness and other things, just handed you a prescription? They didn't give you any other information?
Well, she said that I needed to avoid things with fragrances and stuff like that, but even with that, I've been doing that, and I'm still, they're always dry and peeling, they'll itch, I get the blisters under my skin still, so it's like I'm constantly fighting these flare-ups, and the steroid cream's really expensive, so if there are some ways...
So they gave you an expensive steroid cream, not an inexpensive steroid cream. Okay, I have a number of suggestions here. First of all, question, how often do you shower?
Every other day.
Okay. So reduction in showering makes a difference. We Americans have come used to the concept of we have to have our skin as dry as possible, otherwise we're not clean. And that's bogus. Now, we also believe the French actually smell because they don't shower, and that's equally bogus, by the way. There have been smell tests and sniff tests, and I've received information about this because a number of people of French origin have written me and said that's not the case. So internationally, we know that's not the case. But reduction in the amount of showering you take makes a difference. So washing your hair, for instance, in the sink, and then washing under your armpits and in your perineal area can be a separate way of cleaning yourself without doing your whole body. That's really a very important thing. The reduction in minimal showering makes a difference. What kind of soap do you use when you shower?
Well, I was using just bar soap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, I got some Neutrogena-like sensitive skin soap that's supposed to be very hydrating.
Mm-hmm. You want to use you want a soap that has the least amount of dryness in it. So examples of bad soaps would be Dial, Lifebuoy, Irish Spring, because they are drying soaps. And what you want to try to do is almost use something that is like a soapless cleanser. If you look it up online, you'll see a whole bunch of different kinds. If you go to the drugstore and you talk to the cosmetics lady, they're always cosmetics lady, and you say, which soap is the least drying? That's what you do. You don't want a drying soap. You want a non-drying soap. That's important. But now, what kind of non-medicated oils or creams do you put on your body?
I was using just regular lotion. Some of them were scented. A lot of times I would get them as gifts. You know, I don't really purchase a lot of lotion. But since this, I've been using A&D ointment because it's petroleum-based.
A&D is good. I would look at Cetaphil products, Cetaphil. They make a variety of soaps. They make oils and other products, you know, that are also good, which are good. Aquaphor, Aquaphor, and Eucerin. One is tackier than the other. One is creamier than the other. You want to find oils that you find aesthetically pleasing and are useful at different parts of your body. So you may want to use one in the creases of your arm, one in the back of your knees, and a different oil in other parts of your body. That's a really important thing. Now, let's talk about steroid creams. Triamcinolone cream, TMC, is cheap, inexpensive, and works. And if your dermatologist gave you an expensive cream, you call your dermatologist and you say, I want a triamcinolone cream, 0.1%. I want to try that and see what that works. It also makes, it's a generic. They also come in more concentrated forms. They also come in an ointment form that can be useful. That's what you should use. You should not use the expensive creams first because they're expensive. And your dermatologist, I mean, sometimes they use the cream because the detail person dropped it off, so they're using the most expensive cream. TMC cream is cheap and expensive. It comes in a 454-gram jar that you can have huge amounts. That's what I would go for. If not, I would use betamethasone that also comes in a generic. That's what I would do. And your primary care doctor can also prescribe the TMC cream. You don't need the dermatologist if you're like you are in our group. You can send a note on something called MyChart and Epic. Ask your dermatologist or your primary care doc. Try a cheaper cream. Using it the least, of course, is the most important thing. As for foods, you individually got to try it. Foods sometimes trigger it in some people, and sometimes they don't.
Okay.
I hope that helped.
It really did. Thank you so much. I'm going to try some of this stuff out and definitely check out the TMC stuff.
Yeah, you don't need expensive stuff. You need cheap stuff. And cheap stuff, believe me, works as well, and that's why we use it as the mainstay generic. You don't need an expensive cream to start with. Not at all.
Thank you so much for that call at 800-462-7413.
You know, she brings up a really important point. You go to the pharmacy, you go to the drugstore, and all of a sudden you're stuck with a bill, and it's $100 or $200. And what do? Well, my doctor prescribed it. I'm going to get it. No, don't do that. What you do is you tell the pharmacist, put it back on the shelf, call the doctor, and say, is there a cheaper generic alternative to this? Because a lot of times we'll prescribe, and I'm part of it, and I don't know what it costs. And all of a sudden I'll find on their insurance plan, drug A cost them $200 or $100, and drug B cost them $25. Yeah. And there's a difference, and I don't know. And believe it, the pharmacies, I've talked to the people at Walgreens, for instance, they won't tell you how much the drug costs until they actually run it through the system. And you know what? They can put it back on the shelf. Don't feel like just because you've got an expensive thing, you have to take it. Do not touch the bag. Once you open up the bag and open up the jar, they can't put it back. Don't touch the bag. Think of it as, oh my God, I'm not going to go there, because you want to find out if something is cheaper. Go to goodrx.com, GoodRx.com, to look, by the way, for discounts on your pharmaceuticals. And if you have something that's expensive, call the doc back and say, or the nurse practitioner, and say, I want a cheaper alternative. What is there? It's a team sport. Yeah. And believe me, the pharmaceutical companies and the pharmacies are not always on the same team as the doctors and the patients.
Interesting. 1-800-462-7413 is our number, 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, now let's check the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and tackle another listener email. This one came to us from a listener named Mary, who says she is representing the over 70 group.
Great.
Hello, Dr. Zorba.
I'm part of it, by the way, and so are you.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Would you please address the use of blood thinners such as Xarelto and Eliquis as preventive measures? They seem to have a high risk of consequences and do not seem safe.
Well, first of all, blood thinners, the primary blood thinner has been warfarin for the last gazillion years, and they're called NOACs, the new blood thinners that actually are not like warfarin, where you don't need a blood test, are the new kids on the block. And Blood thinners have side effects because you may bleed too much, so they do have side effects. Mm-hmm. But blood thinners are often given for patients with atrial fibrillation, and not treating them has side effects. We call it stroke. So when you have AFib, you are more likely to have a stroke. So we often give blood thinners like warfarin, Xarelto, Eliquis to prevent stroke in patients. Now, who shouldn't get them? People who fall a lot and may hit their head should not get a blood thinner. People who are elderly and have other medical problems. The drugs are very, very good. The drugs have side effects, and that's where you need a clinician and a doctor, and you mm-hmm. say, what's the risk? What's the benefit? We know that when we start patients who have atrial fib on blood thinners as a group, we reduce the incidence, the prevalence of stroke by at least 50 to 60, maybe 75%. So we know it's actually very worthwhile. And the risk of having a bleed is far less than the risk of having a thrombotic stroke. And that's kind of where we sit. You know, these are not perfectly safe drugs, and they're not perfectly bad drugs. Mm. They're useful drugs.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
Oh, yeah. 800-462-7413 is our number. That's 1-800-462-7413. And before we head out now, Zorba, the show wouldn't be complete without a nod to your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police.
You know, that song gets to me every single time.
The following email came to us from listener Steve in Wethersfield, Connecticut. He writes, Dr. Zorba, most of the times I do not hear a difference between can and can't. Please use can and cannot instead.
I'm not going to do that. There's no way I'm going to say can and cannot. You cannot do this. You can't do this. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. You know something? Sometimes the grammar police just go off the wall with that. So, you know something? He has to get his hearing checked.
Well,
if he cannot tell the difference
between can and
can't.
Can you say can't?
can't. Do this. I like it.
When you hear this show, are you like Mick Jagger and cannot get no satisfaction?
Oh.
Feel free to correct Zorba, as he is contractually obligated to respond. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
I can't wait.
That was what? Can't. If you miss anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or Facebook, of course.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1216Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.